Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Arma, and this is our second last show of the year. We are now officially in December. Time in South Africa sort of slowly calls to a stop, and everyone sort of is unable to focus. I apologize, I think it is also rather wild. But of course, we are joined today by Sargon. Sarah, how are you?
Hi, Nick. No, I'm fine. I'm looking forward to disengaging, shall we say?
Yes, as I'm sure all of our listeners and viewers are as well. And of course, we are also joined by Mr. Michael Morris from Cape Town. Michael, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And I certainly share Sarah's sentiment there. I think, 2021 has been a pretty tough year, really, one way or another. It's almost harder, I think, than 2020. Where we at least felt there might be some definition to the hardship, whereas 2021 it's just broadened out into a kind of never-ending condition of difficulty and
it's been a pretty eventful year. We've had COVID sort of drag on. We've had an important election. We've had political figures moving and shaking on the global stage.
And we've had unrest.
Unrest, of course, as well. Which, as South Africa is, we have this ability to go sort of through crisis, and then crisis, and then crisis, and then sort of back to normal, nothing's wrong.
Crisis is the new normal.
All right, so let us go on to our first story of today, and this is about National Prosecuting Authority head advocate Shamila Batois. A group called Accountability Now is threatening to take her to court in order to force her to investigate and prosecute former President Jacob Zuma, Police Minister Bheki Cele, and a couple of other sort of senior political figures. In a letter to Batois, which was dated 2 months ago, but it's only sort of hitting the media now, the director accused the National Prosecuting Authority boss and her office of dragging their feet in investigating and prosecuting several high-profile cases. So this is quite interesting. The idea here seems to be to prosecute the prosecutors. Now, I'll need Sarah's advice on whether this is likely to have any sort of success, because I don't really understand the law very well. But it just strikes me that we're in a very different position to when Shamila Batois was appointed. I remember when she was appointed, she had a pretty good reputation, and the sort of, in our world of pundits and people who comment on news and stuff, people sort of, you hear lots of whispers and rumors, and people have a kind of word of mouth reputation. And I heard a lot of people say, Shamila Batois, she really might, drive the prosecutions, and you're going to see a lot of the Zuma people locked up. And there was this general feeling that maybe Cyril is the reformer that he was, envisioned to be by many people. But here we are. We're deep into the Ramaphosa presidency, and there haven't really been that many prosecutions, even of people like Ace Makashule, who have fallen out of favor. And he's not being charged by, sort of the big national NPA for corruption. He's only being targeted for stuff that happened in the Free State rather than things like the famous Pioneer painting that he allegedly stole. So, Sarah, firstly, what do you make of this idea of taking the prosecutor to court to get them to prosecute cases? And what do you think of Shamila Batois' reputation and how things are going in the NPA in general?
I think the problem is, as you say, she entered the scene with a lot of gusto. Everyone was very excited. I think we understood that the challenges were considerable. I mean, between the number of people that should face prosecution, the amount of evidence that would have to be gathered, the money that was given to the NPA to do its work, and the fact that the NPA is full of sort of Zuma acolytes.
Political appointees, basically.
And would not make the task easier. I'm not, it's very, you know, I have absolutely no idea how she will have handled those people, whether she would have been able to get them onto, involved in cases that don't concern the political, big weight, sort of the weighty guys. It's very difficult to tell. And as far as I'm aware, I can't recall, but I actually think her funding has been cut when she actually needed it to be increased. And if you consider that a lot of the cases that would have to come up before the courts would involve, would be quite complex, cases. Remember, there would be, prosecutions, so there would be criminal cases. So there's the level, the degree of proof that would have to be offered, provided to the court, would have to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a considerable onus to meet. So, you know, very often, I mean, Accountability Now, which is headed by Paul Hoffman, would obviously know probably a lot more about what is out there, what evidence is available, what can be done. They may well have the, know of the evidence that is available that could prosecute a senior figure and make good of the promise by Ramaphosa that things would happen. It's very difficult otherwise to tell whether, you know, a lot of those sort of guys would be supported by foot soldiers who you'd have to get beyond their evidence and the evidence of their foot soldiers, etc., to try and actually implicate the big guys. They've designed it that way. But the problem is that, you know, nothing that seems to involve people we know well, nothing has come to an end, has resulted in a prosecution. And as the audience member or the viewer points out, you know, what's happened to Julius Malema's firearm prosecution, which theoretically should be a fairly straightforward case. So the problem is one is perturbed by the fact that not a single high-profile figure, even if they're not a Jacob Zuma, but say they've been involved in, talk of Julius Malema, VBS Bank, or the theft of the PNF, nothing seems to be merging. And we're now looking at what, three years down the line. And I think people have, you know, just the sheer apparent lack of results, of inaction, I think is making the public dubious about whether the NPA can pull it off, particularly when measured against the Special Investigative Unit, which has the much easier task of proving on the balance of probabilities that somebody's involved in crime and then being able to then uplift their all their worldly goods while the process otherwise continues. And they've done well on that, but they do have a much smaller onus to meet.
Yeah, I'm always, what sort of is I find really interesting about all this is how, you know, even in countries that have a lot of corruption and even in countries where the leadership of the country is corrupt, you often find that the prosecuting authorities are used to get rid of political opponents, right? So in China, for example, when the Communist Party leadership wants to remove another Communist Party member who is opposing them, they find some corrupt activity that they're involved in because basically everyone has got at least a little bit of corruption going on. And they stick the prosecutors on them and the person goes to jail. That's taken off the political chessboard. You'd think that considering that so many of the people with sort of glaringly obvious corruption cases against them are in the faction that is supposedly opposed to Ramaphosa, that there would be more action or more political incentive for Ramaphosa to take them out, even if he wasn't particularly interested in dealing with corruption overall. And yet, even from that sort of real politique point of view, he doesn't seem to be doing much. Michael, what do you make of this whole issue?
I mean, that's certainly a very interesting point. I think certainly, in the early days, people accepted that one of the difficulties would be that the NPA couldn't rush into court too quickly and then face the risk of failing to secure convictions. And so I think there was a degree of tolerance about that at that point. And I think there's also been quite a bit of attention given to the the possibility that the MPA is being starved of resources or is not being sufficiently resourced. And both of these might still be in play. There might be reasonable factors to bear in mind. But I think, as Sarah says, that the point is, has come where people are beginning to ask these serious questions. Why are these delays? And, you know, it would now, in fact, be up to the MPA really to come clean and say, look, you know, we cannot function with the resources we have. We need more. We need the public on our side to help us demand these things, if that is the case. And so I think, I mean, you know, on the other hand, it's very positive that you do have people like Accountability now. And I see also the other organization, I forget the chap's first name, Lawson. The Council for the Advancement of the Cyber Constitution. So they're also, you know, coming out and saying things publicly. So so this is a very positive thing. People are standing up. It's an indication of a lively monitoring of politics in South Africa and these kinds of institutions. Imagine how bad it would be if that wasn't happening. You know, so on the one hand, you know, there's some comfort to be drawn from the fact that we are still a pretty lively, democratically minded society with these institutions, but it is deeply worrying that, you know, so far into the game, we aren't seeing the kind of action we would have thought. And your question, I mean, I haven't really addressed it, but, you know, the fact that there isn't any indication of decisive political action behind the scenes is, you know, that's quite interesting. I don't really know what the answer might be. But clearly, you know, they're on the hot spot now, and it's going to be difficult for them to evade answering questions about what they're doing. I happen to see one of our listeners commenting that if he or she had performed as poorly, they wouldn't have their job. They'd been fired years ago, and I think a lot of South Africans absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, I like your point about how civil society is pretty active and lively, and as you know, part of that civil society, I like to think the IRR being
exactly.
I think that has been a big part of the reason why South Africa has maintained like quite a democratic outlook, despite the fact that we've had such one party dominance of the state and everything.
Mm. And at a time when I think, you know, most people are far too busy just making ends meet and getting food on the table.
No, exactly.
So we can be thankful at least that these organizations exist.
I think one more point I just want to make before I go to Sarah for final thoughts is that the fact that the EFF seems to often get off on, you know, they're not really, the law doesn't seem to go after them too aggressively. I know that... for example, you know, when the Click stuff happened, there was a case of incitement probably that could have been made against Julius Malema and the EFF leadership. And yet, you know, that kind of went nowhere. The Julius Malema firearms case, who knows where that's going right now. And I think that to me really shows that when it comes to the ANC, they really do just view the EFF a bit like the ANC Youth League. It's still part of the group. Even if it sometimes does things they don't want it to do. And I think that they know that putting Malema in jail might one day hurt their chances of staying in power through a coalition. Anyway, it's just my musings there. Sarah, final thoughts?
Just two things. The first is that while Realpolitik will have the governing ruling party setting up corruption cases against their enemies, I think it's the one thing we have to be pleased about Cyril Ramaphosa not doing, and that is doing nothing about prosecuting, because you don't want to see him in that space. That space must be as independent as is humanly possible. Whether underfunding it and not, you know, I don't know whether that is a sort of back doorway of, putting the brakes on, I don't know. And then, of course, there's the other problem with that the MPA suffers, that it has no control over, and that is that criminal cases have to be investigated by the police. And our police have gone, as a whole, from very poor to almost non-existent.
Yeah, and there's the rub, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, you're relying, the number of sort of good detectives and investigators that you can rely on must have fallen. And that will make things very difficult because, you know, the prosecutors, while they can confer with the police as to stuff they need, they can't.
Right. If you don't have evidence, what are you going to do?
They haven't got. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's an external limitation.
Indeed. Anyway, there's no chance the story is going away because I'm sure that we will hear much more about it next year. I don't think these organizations like Accountability Now are going to give up anytime soon. Let's see what comes of the court challenges. So let's go on to our next event. Every year in December, there is always at least a little bit of outrage about, it's called a lot of different things depending on what part of the country you're in or what school you go to, but, it's called Matric Rage, it's called VAC, it's called the end of the year bash, whatever. And this is basically where a whole bunch of kids, usually from sort of middle class Model C schools or, from private schools, go down to the coast, usually in KZN, and they have, sort of debaucherous week or so of teenage hijinks to celebrate the fact that they have just finished school, and this involves lots of drinking and sex and getting into trouble on beaches and mucking about and vomiting in places, all that kind of stuff that young people are known for. And every year it gets people really upset for some good reasons and some not so good reasons. And of course, this year we are having a much stronger reaction against it because of fears around COVID-19, particularly the new Omicron variant, which we still know very little about. And we're still probably a couple of weeks away from knowing much about from the early sort of lab tests. But KZN Premier Sihle Zikalala has appealed to parents and pupils not to organize or take part in events and celebrations that might flout COVID-19 safety protocols. Reports are indicating that with the end of year and the end of school, pupils, especially matriculants, have started to converge in KZN for events such as Rage and others known as throw away the pen after parties. At most of these events, younger people gather in large groups and, drink a lot of booze. So, you know, if you were to imagine a super spreader event, apart from a sort of mass sauna of old people, this is possibly the worst kind of thing for a super spreader event. And yet at the same time, I must say, you know, I'm sympathetic to the youth in this case, going out and partying. I don't know. I haven't really made up my mind yet on this issue. Let me start with you, Michael. Just remember to unmute your mic. What do you make of this issue?
I think I'm inclined to think that you're probably right. I mean, there's a level of fatigue, but also confusion that's set in around the whole COVID thing. We told things which appear to be conflicting or kind of assuring almost in a way. People say, you know, we've got very high herd immunity, vaccinations are going well, Omicron is, you know, a milder version. There's so many conflicting things. Other people saying the opposite here. We've got to be much more careful. My sense is, especially among young people, that they've reached a point where they, you know, just really want to let their hair down and just relax for a bit and so on. And I'm sure there are health risks. My inclination would be to listen to maybe the family doctor. Just bring it right down to somebody you can talk to and say, what do you think is the best thing here? But on the other hand, I mean, one can't help thinking that maybe the greatest risk they face is kind of undue exposure to alcohol, unprotected sex, and possibly bad music, and death on the road. I mean, that's probably the worst thing.
Drunk driving is probably going to be more dangerous for young people than COVID.
But certainly, if I had a child going off, I would think quite seriously about maybe I probably would consult somebody, maybe the family doctor, and say, what do you really think, you know, we should do? It's a difficult one. I noticed when I was visiting Joburg last week that so many people aren't wearing masks anymore there. I don't know if that was just...
Yeah, I think that's definitely a symptom of the fatigue you mentioned. People are just sort of... What is it? They're just over it.
Over it.
You know, you could still probably have a rage party at the coast without, putting yourself in too much danger. Sorry, just to have beforehand get plastered on the beach rather than going to a nightclub.
Well, there we go. Yeah. Probably much more fun. And more scared to get up to mischief too, probably.
Yeah, probably. What do you make of this?
I think the government should regard it as a great opportunity to put in place a vaccination passport scenario. So you get the youth vaccinated, and that may be important because the new variant appears, although it's unconfirmed, to be attacking the youth. And to Michael and I, that means anyone under 40. rather than attacking the older age groups as it has previously. So there is a risk. And, you know, the reality is, of course, vaccinations do not stop you getting the disease. They only mitigate the possibility and reduce the possibility of dying. But also, I suppose the thing is that you get them vaccinated and it reduces, doesn't get rid of, but it reduces the possibility of passing on to older family back home. So it's an ideal opportunity to sort of get a host of the nation sort of encouraged to be vaccinated. Let's put it that way. I can understand the hair letting down aspect. I suppose this is where you discover whether your child is cautious and has a good sense of self-preservation or doesn't, as the case may be. But I think I would rather try and see it as an opportunity for vaccination and let the kids go with a whole lot of warnings, because I think kids need it as badly as adults would if they did the same thing, which they're too old to do. But I can understand the need to break out.
I believe that, generally speaking, the case overseas, and I'm not sure about South Africa, but I wouldn't be surprised if the same pattern holds here, is that young people are actually far more open to getting vaccinated and far more worried about COVID because they don't want to give it to their parents or something like that. So I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if
most kids
young kids are, particularly the sort of middle-class kids going down to the beach, are actually probably going to be pretty responsible when it comes to this sort of stuff.
And they're older teenagers, so it's not as if you have to try and deal with much younger children and whether they should or shouldn't be vaccinated. These are kids mostly 18 and older, a couple younger, but not much. And they are. I mean, as soon as the vaccinations became available to younger cohorts, the youngsters responded. They had a different response, by and large, to the middle age and the older. So might well... have at least that benefit,
Anyway, I think probably at the end of the day, the best solution here is just to let people decide by themselves rather than, you know, closing the beaches again like we had during the hard lockdown, which was just so stupid. Anyway. Let's go overseas to talk about a story on the international stage. And that is... about CNN anchor Chris Cuomo. So he's a pretty big figure in CNN's lineup. I think he's one of their evening news hosts. He does a news show, and it has one of the highest ratings, I think, of any of CNN's programs. His brother is Andrew Cuomo, who until recently was the governor of New York, the state of New York. And Chris Cuomo has... for most of his political career, because he's involved in reporting specifically on political news for the most part, he stayed away from interviewing his brother, just saying that it was not kosher and that it just wouldn't, you know, it wasn't proper. But he broke this rule during COVID, saying that it was more important that they had a sort of good cheer, a good news story to tell. And CNN really kind of built up this image of Andrew Cuomo as this kind of COVID fighter, a politician who was really taking the disease seriously. But then everything started to fall apart. It emerged that Andrew Cuomo had made some very questionable decisions with regards to putting old people who weren't recovered yet from COVID back into old age homes in order to save space in the hospitals. And this may have resulted in a large number of deaths. And then even worse than that, it appears that he may have tried to cover this up at the same time. And then he was also accused by a whole raft of women of being sexually assaulting them or acting improperly towards them or trying to basically bully them into having sex with him or to that kind of thing. He fought it very hard, but in the end, there was a lot of pressure on him and he resigned. Now, during this time, Chris Cuomo from CNN was known publicly to be part of his brother's sort of reaction team that was helping him to craft a media narrative in defense of himself. Now, so that's a little bit of a problematic situation, considering that, you know, he's also supposed to be a sort of news host for the supposedly objective news organization. However, some court documents have now been released, and there is an allegation being made against Chris Cuomo that not only did he sort of assist his brother with advice, but he may have potentially have used his sort of CNN contacts and credentials to try and find dirt on some of the women accusing his brother of sexual harassment. Now, we don't know that yet. It's still got to be proved in court. But as a result of this allegation, CNN said yesterday that they were suspending him indefinitely until such a time as there's been further evaluation. Not a great look for CNN. Michael, what do you make of this?
I mean, I'm not a follower of US media to the extent that I watch a lot of CNN or know much about Chris Cuomo, but certainly, I mean, from a general kind of media perspective, the only thing that a journalist is the only way to measure a journalist's worth is really their credibility, and that depends on their independence. I think and the same applies to a media organization or big flagship broadcasting outfit. And so I think where there's any doubts about the independence of your key people and the sort of public face of your media offering, you absolutely have a problem. And so I think their response is completely understandable. It falls very much, I think, within the convention of kind of media practice in circumstances like these. It's obviously not a science. It often comes down to gestures. Some people are let off more lightly than others. It can often be very unfair. But it's very much a convention. I was thinking a little earlier about an incident before, in fact, I joined the Cape Argus, but somebody told me about the previous editor who had once been caught on a drunk driving charge. And the morning that he appeared in court, he sauntered into the newsroom, went up to the news desk and said, "Please make sure there's a reporter in court for I'm appearing on a charge of drunken driving." And, you know, it's kind of set the bar for a kind of ethical treatment of news that affected us, and it's part of our code of conduct, I remember, was that we report ourselves as dispassionately and accurately as we report anyone else. So it's a good convention, but there's a lot more lies behind it, and it's not always strictly either fair or a fair reflection of whatever sins may or may not have been committed.
Sarah, in about sort of 90 seconds, your thoughts.
Well, he's very woke, as is most of his colleagues on CNN, if not all of them. So I think the word schadenfreude comes to mind with him, because there have been instances where he's gone on television and either hasn't had the facts or has been plain dishonest. And I'm sure CNN will have taken to hashtag MeToo movement with gusto, as protecting and supporting women who have been harassed by middle-aged men. And look what happens. His brother is accused of harassing women, and he's accused of trying to dig up the dirt on them. Like I said, I think what goes around, et cetera, et cetera. So not much sympathy from me.
Yeah, and it is quite a fall, because CNN, of course, you know, coming out of the first Iraq war, made its name as this kind of cutting-edge news television station that was watched all over the world and really set the international agenda. And they really seem like they've been floundering for the last couple of years. They're not as big as they used to be in terms of viewership, and they just don't seem to have the credibility. I mean, if you look at the live comments here, one of our viewers said, no one believes they're objective. And I think there are a significant number of people who really wouldn't trust CNN with their shopping cart. Anyway, with that, I think that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for joining us. I just want to encourage you, please, if you enjoy this stuff, please go to thedailyfriend.co.za, read our stuff, support us there, or you can SMS your name to 32823 to become a small donor of the Institute of Race Relations, which, of course, funds the Daily Friend Show. Anyway, thank you very much, and have a most excellent and wonderful day, everyone. Cheers.